Welcome to Metro Connection. I'm Rebecca Shear, and today we're focusing on one of those topics people tend to tiptoe around, a topic right up there with politics and religion in terms of its ability to stir things up. We're talking about race and ethnicity, and we'll spend the next hour exploring how these topics are entwined with Washington's past, present, and future. We'll go back to the 1800s, when a group of former slaves and free African Americans founded their own school in the nation's capital. We'll examine why one particular minority group is disproportionately involved in pedestrian deaths in the suburbs, and we'll visit a bustling Latino neighborhood in Northern Virginia and find out why its future is so uncertain. First, though, let's talk about 1939. Maurice Jackson teaches history and African American studies at Georgetown, and as he points out, 1939 was a pivotal year for race relations in America.
There's so much going on because that's the same year, of course, Billie Holiday sings Strange Fruit.
Which, of course, is the haunting tune that shook the jazz world and stoked support for the country's anti-lynching measures.
It's also the same year that in Washington, D.C., that Ahmed Erdogan and his brother have this big concert.
Big as in the district's first integrated concert, performed by an interracial jazz orchestra at the Jewish Community Center.
And so you have a Muslim man bringing black music to a Jewish center. So it's quite amazing.
But the amazement of 1939 doesn't end there, because on Easter Sunday, here on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, more than 75,000 people witnessed this. Performance by the great African-American contralto Marian Anderson, who had been barred from Constitution Hall. That historic event is the one we're going to focus on here, because it recently drew this Washington native.
I'm Carol Olivia Heron. I wrote the words for the opera, Let Freedom Sing, the story of Marian Anderson.
Into a bit of a mystery.
I don't know if you ever saw it on the internet. It was like it was viral.
All right, more than a bit of a mystery, perhaps. But in any case, the mystery was this.
Whether or not anybody remembers the sign of for colored only in Washington, D.C. around 1939.
Just to back up a bit, you know that opera Carol Olivia mentioned?
Let Freedom Sing, the story of Marian Anderson.
It premiered in 2009 here in D.C., and now Carol Olivia is adapting it as a book for young readers with help from this Washington-based artist.
My name is Kay Shladuaheri, and I'm originally from Sri Lanka, but I've lived in the district for more than 20 years now.
Kay is doing all the illustrations, and what happened was she recently worked up this drawing, kind of a montage, really, showing Marian Anderson being shut out of Constitution Hall and her brother Jack looking angry.
And I wanted to give some indication of why Jack was so angry. So I put in a sign saying colored with an arrow. And it started all this furor about whether Washington, D.C. had signs, overt signs for segregation.
Keisha showed the picture to Carol Olivia, who not only grew up in D.C., but distinctly remembers her family blockbusting a neighborhood in Northwest. And when it came to colored-only signs in the 1930s, Carol Olivia says her mother, Georgia, had told her,
in strong terms, that the first time she ever saw such a sign was when she went to Virginia. So that when I saw Dear Cashier made a picture with the for colored only sign, essentially, I just said, it can't be.
And that is when things started to get, as Carol Olivia would put it, viral. She asked members of the historic Washington listserv to chime in about colored only signs in 1939 and received a slew of responses.
I have some brilliant, wonderful answers to the question.
But ever the scholar, Carol Olivia does, after all, hold a PhD in comparative lit. She wanted definitive answers from firsthand sources.
And since we needed some people who were alive in 1939, we went out and found three of them.
And all three of these lifelong Washingtonians, from Betty Lichtenstein,
I have never seen a sign in Washington,
to Charles Cassell,
nor have I,
to Carol Olivia's mother, Georgia,
there were no signs.
Agree, D.C. had no public signage formally barring blacks from certain facilities back in 1939. Rather, in those days, Georgia says what was happening was more like custom, what she calls an unwritten law.
You knew where you could go and where you were welcome and so forth. Mm-hmm. Starting out with our parents And then our teachers, our pastor and all, they told us where we could go, and we knew how to act.
Now, of course, you did see official segregation, rigid segregation in Washington's housing, jobs, and schools at the time. But when it came to day-to-day things like going out to eat or shopping, as Georgia says, it was far more subtle. So subtle, in fact, that Betty, who grew up white in a black neighborhood in Southwest, says she hardly was aware of segregation at places like, say, Woodford and Lothrop, D.C.'s first department store.
Somebody said that Woody's didn't allow black people to try on clothes or use the bathrooms. I probably was unaware. I do know the woman who spoke about not being able to go to Glen Echo. Now, how would you know that you're not supposed to?
You, just like you know everything else, just like my mother described, we knew we could not go. It was in the air. I wish I could remember the first person who told me.
Well, while Cara Olivia Herron can't recall who first clued her in, Charles Cassell says in his case, nobody really clued him in at all.
My parents never talked much about that. My mother was constantly protecting me from anything that she thought would damage my little psyche.
So Charles says he discovered a lot of things on his own, like when he was 14 and pedaled his brand new bike up into a white neighborhood.
Well, what did I know? I was having a good time riding my bicycle and discovering new places, you know? Whereupon a white policeman stopped me and said, "Boy, what you doing up here in this neighborhood?" I said, "I'm riding my bicycle, man. What do you think? You better get back down there where you belong. Get on down there, boy." So I turned around and went home, and I was angry, you know?
In fact, it was events like this that led to Charles Cassell's eventual involvement in the civil rights movement. Word has it he went to jail at least once with that famous firebrand Julius Hobson. But moving back to 1939, Georgia Herron, who actually saw Marian Anderson sing that Easter Sunday, says she can hardly believe the changes she's seen in Washington.
The atmosphere is different. Now, if I go to a place that I know was originally all white, I'm proud. I feel better. And I know what the meaning of freedom is.
And granted, says Maurice Jackson, race relations in D.C. are far from perfect. When it comes to whites and blacks, we still see disparities, like when it comes to income.
Listen, in Washington, D.C., the average white person makes $3.11 for every dollar a black person makes. The average white family makes $101,000. Average black family, $39,000. Now, average.
But he points to another momentous occasion here at the Lincoln Memorial, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech, and says that remarkable event gives him hope.
Can you imagine seeing just a throng of people of all different colors and races in 1963 when people are still being beaten? It shows you the great possibilities, but it shows you the great obligation of American people to make sure that this society reaches its dream of full equality.
And ideally, this dream isn't subtle or unwritten, but sung from every mountainside, so freedom does indeed ring.
This land is your land. This land is my land. From California, well, to the New York Island. From the Redwood Forest.
We reach even further back into the district's history now and visit the years before the Civil War. That was when a group of emancipated slaves and free African Americans came together to start a school in Northwest D.C. And as Jessica Gould tells us, more than 150 years later, St. Augustine Catholic School maintains its mission, even as the city continues to change around it.
In Lorraine Lee's 7th grade social studies class, students are playing a game called King for a Day, as in Martin Luther King Jr.
One thing that you would change right now, what would it be?
The education, how kids are skipping school.
Ooh, I love that. Education.
In fact, St. Augustine has always been about changing the nature of education in Washington. Father Patrick Smith is pastor of St. Augustine Catholic Church, which sponsors the school.
The community was really started by freed African-Americans in Washington as well as emancipated slaves. At that time, there was no public education for African-Americans.
So even before parishioners had their own church, they decided to build a school.
There was a reason that it was illegal to teach a slave to read, because reading education was a path to freedom, and the school was a way of really offering opportunities for our children.
The school opened its doors in 1858, and for several years before the Civil War, and through decades of legalized segregation after, Smith says St. Augustine provided a safe space for students to pray and learn.
It was a place where you really could celebrate your faith with your dignity intact.
Then, during the late 1960s, the school near U Street became a haven for students living in a community crackling with protest. Andrea Stallworth Verstraete and her siblings attended St. Augustine during those tumultuous years.
I remember when the riots came through the district and seeing people running up and down 14th Street, shattering storefronts, and the education and the support that the nuns had to give us through these transitions here in Washington, incorporating that into our education and trying to get us to understand not only what happened, but how that impacted us as a Black people here in Washington.
But the situation outside the school didn't just seep into the classrooms. Father Patrick Smith says school leaders also took to the streets.
It was not unusual, for example, to have, at the time of the riots and the curfews, the religious sister Diables riding shotgun on trucks, you know, telling people to go back inside.
Meanwhile, Stallworth Verstraete says the school and its principal offered sanctuary from the stresses of home.
My parents got divorced while I was here, and she would bring us in and sit and talk to us about it. And it was so positive because we were very scared. She protected us. You know, and I always had the image of her in the mornings coming out to the playground and saying, I want all of you to come in and stay with me until school starts.
But St. Augustine has also faced its own challenges, especially in recent years, as climbing costs and declining enrollments have made it difficult for many Catholic schools to survive.
In 2007, it was announced that about 8 schools, including St. Augustine, were going to be closed and converted to public charter schools.
So, as it had more than 150 years ago, the church community swung into action.
The key to us was not only the contribution, financial contribution, but also the contribution of a lot of the wisdom and talent of the community.
Smith says St. Augustine Catholic Church is the largest benefactor to the school, spending hundreds of thousands of dollars every year to help cover operating costs.
We have a legacy of people who had less than we do, who did extraordinary things. We can choose to applaud them, but they'd be much more happy if we imitated them.
Still, even its founders would be surprised to see the school that exists today. St. Augustine now serves about 200 students from pre-K through 8th grade. And a Nigerian order, the Handmaids of the Holy Child Jesus, has taken the helm. Principal Gloria Mary Agumagu says she and her sisters were called to preserve the mission of the school and connect students to their peers across the globe.
We are a group of people, Africans, African-American, in a vast community.
While St. Augustine remains predominantly Black, it now serves a diversity of students from all over the world. Eighth grader Lelo Nagera is school president.
I'm from Ethiopia. I came here in 2003, and when I learned the history of this school, it was just made me realize how special the school really is and how hard the people actually fought for us to go to school.
So, as Lorraine Lee teaches about the fight for freedom,
because we are people of all what?
Color.
That's right.
She tells students to look around and learn from each other. I'm Jessica Gould.
After the break, dropping out and struggling to survive. We'll meet a family where multiple generations are trying to make it without high school diplomas.
Only income I have is food stamps. I go to people that I know around here, you know, older ladies go washing for them or something. I get a little change. But I try to save that or to get some things that we need here, you know, like 99-cent dishwash liquid or something.
Coming your way on Metro Connection here on WAMU 88.5.
WAMU news coverage of labor and employment issues is made possible by your contributions and by Matthew Watson, in memory of Marjorie Watson. And support for our news coverage of the environment comes from the Wallace Genetic Foundation, serving the Washington area through the promotion of farmland preservation, natural resource conservation, and environmental education.
I'm Rebecca Shear, and welcome back to Metro Connection. Today we're talking race and ethnicity, and this next story is about the relationship between ethnicity and cultural norms, and how those norms can affect our lives in unusual and dramatic ways. In Montgomery County, Maryland, a striking number of Latino residents are involved in fatal pedestrian accidents. And now community leaders and police are working to change that. Jonathan Wilson has more in our weekly transportation segment from A to B.
At first glance, there's nothing particularly unusual about the intersection of Piney Branch Road and University Boulevard. Yes, it's usually packed with cars, but that's hardly a novelty for an intersection in the Washington metropolitan area. Michael Petrick with the Latino advocacy group Casa de Maryland points to the four bus stops along University Boulevard, all only about an eighth of a mile from the traffic light. He says people hopping off or onto buses just don't see the value in walking up to the crosswalks to get across the street.
You also have a lot of low-income Latinos who work and live around here who don't have cars and need to get to work, so they'll cross the street as quickly as possible in order to get the next job opportunity or to catch the next bus.
Buses stop here every few minutes, and you can see people strolling or jogging across the road's six lanes of traffic almost as often. We even watch two women pushing strollers scurry across the road nowhere near a crosswalk. Petrick says pedestrian safety has been an issue here as long as Casa's had its building near this intersection.
We've been here for about 25 years, and we've seen a lot of the incidents where people are crossing the street. Either they're not paying attention, the cars aren't paying attention, and accidents happen, and unfortunately it happens a lot to Latinos in this community.
The number of pedestrian accidents has been down in Montgomery County over the past several years, according to the Metropolitan Washington Council of Governments. But Latinos continue to be overrepresented as victims of pedestrian fatalities. AAA Mid-Atlantic says of the 11 pedestrian fatalities in the county last year, 5 of the victims, or 45%, were identified as Hispanic or Latino. That's even though the group only makes up approximately 17% of the county's population. Through an interpreter, Guatemalan immigrant Christian Molina, who has just walked across University Boulevard himself, smiles and says he doubts things will change anytime soon.
It's a culture thing. Latinos are just used to taking the short way, and it doesn't matter if the crosswalk is on the other side.
Even if that's the case, CASA and Montgomery County's Department of Transportation say a culture change is in order. Michael Petrick holds up one of the new reusable grocery bags CASA started handing out around Thanksgiving. On the bag is a new pedestrian safety motto in Spanish and English.
Sé seguro, sé astuto, sé visible, which is be safe, be smart, and be visible, or be seen. They're in bright green, which is important because a lot of the incidents that happen, especially in this area, are early morning or late afternoon.
The county is doing its part by adding new bilingual messages on sidewalks, reminding pedestrians where and where not to cross. And recently installed beeping pedestrian signals should help as well. CASA staffer Jose Velasquez says he's been trying to warn more people at bus stops about darting across the road. But through an interpreter, he says pedestrians and drivers need to be more careful.
Drivers are not careful of pedestrians. They don't let pedestrians cross on the crosswalks. And people just run through the road, and that's a big problem and a big risk for the pedestrian also.
Michael Petrick says while people running across six lanes of traffic is obviously a bad idea, there are little things even pedestrians native to the area do that add to the risk of a collision.
People crossing 5, 6, 7 feet out of the crosswalk. People crossing too late. People waiting to cross the crosswalk with 1 foot in the street. These are little incidents that, if the wrong set of circumstances happen, could lead to very disastrous consequences.
Whether pedestrians are longtime residents or Spanish-speaking immigrants, CASA and the county are hoping to create more like Lila Molina, who says she doesn't mind taking a few more steps even when she's in a hurry.
Me gusta respetar las señales de tránsito.
I like to respect the law and go through the crosswalk.
I'm Jonathan Wilson.
The civil rights issue of our time. That's what U.S. Education Secretary Arne Duncan has called the number of students who drop out of high school every year in the United States. The total is about 1 million, and minority students are disproportionately affected, with only about 50% of Black, Latino, and Native American students receiving a high school diploma. Education reporter Kavitha Cardoza kicks off a series on the problem with this story about a D.C. family with more than a dozen risk factors for dropping out, including learning disabilities, teen pregnancy, and drug abuse. And as she tells us, history has repeated itself generation after generation.
She walks me to death.
Yep.
She got me zigzagging.
Sondra Walker and her daughter Grace McMillan have lots of happy times together. These moments help them forget some of the challenges they face every day. When Sondra Walker was a little girl, she had big dreams.
I wanted to be a big lawyer. I wanted to fight crime some kind of way.
Sondra's mother got pregnant and dropped out of school when she was 14. She worked as a maid all her life and insisted Sondra stay in school. Sondra says she loved her time and teachers in middle school, especially one.
Miss Rosa. It was like a class for slow children, but she took her time with us to, you know, show us, not tell us, but to show us.
But after sixth grade, as she says, the dream dropped.
Back in the 60s, they put everybody, all the slow kids in one class, put something on the board, then the person to lead the room. Nobody explained to us how to do it. We do not know what we're doing.
Sondra felt her teachers didn't care and she wasn't learning. Then she became pregnant. And at 17, Sondra dropped out of high school. She didn't foresee any long-term consequences because she got work right away.
My first job was like working on the grill, slicing meat.
A string of minimum wage jobs followed.
The last job I had was 2008. It was cafeteria work. Because I didn't have a high school diploma, they couldn't keep me on.
Today, Sondra lives in free public housing and Medicaid pays her medical bills. She struggles to survive.
Only income I have is food stamps. I go to people that I know around here, you know, older ladies, go washing for them or something. I get a little change. But I try to save that or to get some things that we need here, you know, like 99-cent dishwash liquid or something.
Just for a moment, her warm and wise face crumples.
Some dreams don't come true. They don't.
Sondra has given up her dreams of becoming a lawyer and owning her own house. But a GED certificate seems within reach, even though classes aren't easy. At 58, Sondra thinks she reads at the third grade level. But the teachers at her school, Academy of Hope, are kind, so she keeps at it.
If I leave this world today, I can always say that I did get it because I made a promise to my mother. It would make me feel more full. I want it so bad. Ooh, I would want it.
One of Sondra's biggest disappointments is three of her four children dropped out of high school. She says it felt like history repeating itself when she couldn't convince her children to change their minds.
I was angry. I hollered. I said, you want to be like me? I said, look what I'm doing. Look what I'm doing. Nothing. Nothing.
Sondra's foster daughter, Grace McMillan, is 44. Sondra raised her since she was 13 years old and homeless. Grace loved school. She had lots of friends and was in the choir and in ROTC. But there was a problem.
I just didn't understand a lot of different things. I was always passed from class to class, grade to grade. And I used to ask what was wrong with my brain.
When Grace was 16, she got pregnant. She dropped out of school 2 years later for a series of low-paying jobs. Cleaning, cooking, construction.
I was working and working and working. I'm a workaholic.
On the side, Grace had an informal catering business. And for a time, life was good.
We had ribs, chicken, fish sandwiches, two different types of cake, a butter cake and a chocolate cake.
Her face is pure joy as she lists the menu.
And homemade gravy, real homemade gravy with mushrooms, onions and green peppers. It was like, wow. We was making some money. We was making some pretty money.
Then the recession hit and orders dried up. And when Grace needed time off her day job for surgery, she was laid off. She can't find other work, so she's enrolled in GED classes along with her mother. Her dreams of joining the Air Force have long evaporated, except for brief moments when she thinks of how her life might have turned out.
It'd be so different. I'd probably live in a base.
I'll be living on base, me and my family.
Grace has four children, and worrying about one of them, 22-year-old Cameron has consumed a lot of her time and energy.
He has the beautifulest smile. He's my firstborn son.
Memories of Cameron are all she has now. He's in federal prison in Kentucky, more than 300 miles away. Cameron struggled in school because of learning disabilities. When he was 12, his father walked out and never spoke to him again. Grace says he went from a child who did homework every day to a child who didn't care if he was in class.
Hooking school, being picked up by the truant officer, smoking in the stairwells, riding in stolen cars, standing out there with the drug boys. He felt that the last alternative is to be out there on the streets looking for a father figure. That's what it's really about.
His behavior escalated. Then when he was 19, one sunny summer afternoon, Cameron was shot 16 times.
You hear gunshots. Somebody called the phone, an accident. All you could hear is, Cameron! That tore everything and everybody apart.
Cameron recovered and continued life on the streets. According to court documents, he has 10 adult arrests, including distributing cocaine and assaulting a police officer. Then last year, on the 4th of July, he went up to a teenager and hit him on the head with a gun. Cameron took his cell phone, shoes and ID. A few hours later, he robbed four others, assaulting one of them as well. The judge says Cameron has built up what she calls a criminal resume. He's locked up for armed robbery and unlawful possession of a firearm. The earliest he could be released is 2017.
I lost my son to the streets. And I tell anybody, if they could help their kids, don't allow them to throw their life away just because they want to.
Four generations of this family haven't graduated. And as they continue to struggle with poverty, poor health and teen pregnancy, it's not clear whether or how the cycle could be broken. Cameron himself is a father. Before he went to prison, he apologized in court to the mothers of his two children. One son is a year old and the other is 7 months. I'm Kavitha Kadoza.
This story was produced with help from Ginger Morid. It's part of American Graduate, Let's Make It Happen, a public media initiative supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting to help local communities address the dropout crisis. To see photos from this story and to learn more about the project, visit our website, metroconnection.org. Race, ethnicity, and the environment. For years, they were words you never really heard together in the same sentence. But it turns out the majority of people who live within 2 miles of the country's hazardous waste sites are minorities. And for a variety of reasons, minority communities are often among the most affected by so-called legacy pollution, the toxins that tend to stick around for years and years and years. Dennis Chestnut heads the local grassroots organization Groundwork Anacostia. He's been fighting pollution and contamination east of the river for decades, and he recently spoke with environment reporter Sabri Benashour. They met in Ward 7 in Marvin Gaye Park, right next to a new litter trap, a giant skimmer that removes floating trash from the water.
It's floatable, so as the water level rises, it rises as well. We've averaged about a little under 800 pounds a month of litter that we've taken out of there.
And where are we right now?
We're in far northeast. The largest stream or tributary to the Anacostia River runs through here, and it's called Watts Branch.
Are environmental problems kind of spread out all around D.C., or does east of the river get an unfair share of it?
Well, there's some legacy involved with that. It is spread out all over the city, but on the eastern end of the city, from the far end of Ward 6 and Ward 8, all the way through Ward 7 and Ward 5, you have some hot spots. This is where the rail lines run through. The power plant, Pepco Power Plant, is located right here in northeast, right on the river. I can remember when I was a child and how upset my father would be when he would come out to go to church on a Sunday morning and have to clean off his car after he had washed it on Saturday to be ready to go to church. He would have to come out and clean the residue from the soot that was being burned, the coal that was being burned over at the Pepco power plant, it used to saturate the entire area. If the car was catching that, you can imagine what people were breathing. And the only landfill that ever existed in Washington, D.C., it was the landfill for Washington, D.C., is located here in Northeast Washington. Fortunately, not open now, closed in 1970. Washington Gas had a major facility along the Anacostia River in Ward 6. It's a legacy that now has to be cleaned up. These are all areas that all directly impact not just the river, but the communities where they're located as well.
And is it that these areas used to be industrial areas that so many of these sites happen to land here?
Absolutely. These areas were areas because of the river. The river was, the Anacostia River was a major commerce took place along that river. The port in Bladensburg at one time was 40 feet deep. And of course, as you know, there was a Navy Yards, and with the industry comes workers. And the workers who primarily did that work at the early periods of time were primarily minorities, people of color, and other ethnic groups as well. It wasn't just African Americans.
When you have a community like this one here, unemployment is extremely high here. There are a lot of issues. How do you get a community that has a lot of other challenges going on to get invested in something like the environment?
That is truly a major challenge. And one of the reasons that you find a lot of the other communities able to focus on things like the health of the polar bears and things of that nature, because they're not inundated day to day with just basic survival. And when basic survival is such a challenge, that becomes what you concentrate on. So that's one of the major things that contributes to why there's a lack of focus on the environment. But it's layered. We need the schools to be more focused on it. That's beginning to happen. What it takes is commitment and dedication at various levels. So this activity that we're engaged in today is one of those activities and one of those layers. This litter trap is very visible. It will serve as a great outreach tool for the wider community. It sits right in the middle of where school children pass on a daily basis. I was talking to a gentleman this morning who lives just across the street, came over, wanted to know what this was all about. So that is one way that the community can become informed and their stewardship level can be raised.
Well, here's the future then. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it.
That was environment reporter Sabri Benashour speaking with Dennis Chestnut of Groundwork Anacostia. In a minute, the return of our monthly series, The Location. This time around, we visit an iconic U Street mural that'll soon disappear from public view.
He went through a shoebox and picked out photographs of generations and generations of his family. And that's what you're seeing, generations of one African-American family from Washington, D.C., from this neighborhood.
That and more on Metro Connection here on WAMU 88.5. Welcome back to Metro Connection. I'm Rebecca Shear, and this week we're exploring stories of race and ethnicity. An apropos topic, given the veritable cornucopia of cultures here in the National Capital Region. And if you travel around the Washington area, you'll find certain areas possess particularly rich cultural histories. Like, for example, Northwest D.C.'s U Street Corridor. Once known as Black Broadway, the corridor used to be home to the largest urban African-American community in the country. And in the 1960s, the neighborhood became a hub for activism against legal segregation and racism. These days, to see reminders of the area's African-American culture and heritage, all you have to do is look around and up. And that's the direction we'll be looking in this week's edition of The Location. Our regular segment where Kim Bender, who writes the blog The Location, brings us the often surprising stories behind well and lesser known sites around the D.C. region. This time around, we're visiting that famous U Street corridor, just three blocks north of U. So what location are we visiting today, Kim Bender?
So here we are on the corner of 14th and Florida, right above U Street. And we're looking at the Black Family Reunion mural, which was painted on the wall above the Latino Auto Sales building in 1994 by G. Byron Peck.
I'm sure many people have noticed it as they've been walking by or driving by. I know I have, and I've always wondered what the story is. But before we get to the story of it, can you describe what it looks like?
The mural is a collage of 6 photographs, all different sizes, of different family groups. They're actually all from the same family. The man who painted the mural, G. Byron Peck, had a friend in the neighborhood, and he went through a shoebox that this man had and picked out photographs of generations and generations of his family. And that's what you're seeing, generations of one African-American family from Washington, D.C., from this neighborhood.
And G. Byron Peck, he's done several murals around town, and he's got some really, really well-known ones.
Yes, and actually, sometime in the 90s, he was interviewed as having estimated that he had painted 300,000 square feet of D.C. wall space. There's a Duke Ellington mural on U Street that used to be, when you came out of the U Street Metro, you could see it. But when they did changes to the Metro entrance, it was on removable panels, and it moved down the street onto the True Reformer building. And actually, his first large-scale mural in the city was on the wall of Asia Nora, but it's since closed down and the building was actually knocked down, which is interesting because a lot of his murals, being in an urban environment on the sides of buildings, have been torn down or blocked. And that's what we are going to see happen to this mural too, the Black Family Reunion. Probably by the end of the year, we're not sure exactly when, Douglas Development is going to be building a 6-story apartment building, and it will be covering up the Black Family Reunion mural.
How does he feel about the fact that this one's going to be more or less obscured?
Well, I asked him how he feels about all of his murals being obscured, and he said, you never get over the feeling of, oh, it's not there anymore, but it's just the fact of urban development. He also pointed out something that I thought was really interesting. The reason why he's been able to do his murals on the sides of these buildings is because the buildings next door, in lots of cases, were burnt out during the riots and came down, so they were empty lots. So now you had brick walls that he could use and create his art, but it's those same empty lots now that the neighborhood is changing and maybe more economic development is coming in, that developers want those same lots, and that will obscure his artwork. There was a mural of Frederick Douglass on the corner of a building on Massachusetts and 12th.
And in Northwest.
And he said he was coming home from the airport one day and he saw there was a hole in the lot, like they had started digging foundation. He said, oh, I think it's going to go soon. But they didn't put the building flush up against the painting. So if you peer through the little tiny gap, like not even a foot gap in between, you can kind of see it. I think the edge of Mr. Peck's name is still visible.
Can we talk a little bit about how this one came to be? Is there actually an event called the Black Family Reunion?
There is an event called the Black Family Reunion. It's celebrated 26 years. It's sponsored by the National Council of Negro Women. They describe it as celebrating the enduring strength and traditional values of the African-American family. And they gather down on the mall every year, and it's a big celebration.
Something else really noteworthy, I think, about this mural, and kind of weird, to be perfectly honest, in the lower right-hand corner, I'm sure some of our listeners have noticed, it says sponsored by McDonald's, and there's the McDonald's logo. What's the story behind that?
It was sponsored by McDonald's. Mr. Peck painted this at a time where the arts funding was hard to come by, so he had approached companies to fund his different projects. This was funded by McDonald's, and they came up with a theme. And then the only thing that he had to do besides do it based on their theme was put the logo in.
So McDonald's is the sponsor, and they came up with the theme. But
it was actually the National Black McDonald's Operators Association,
okay,
which is like the franchise organization for African-American owners of McDonald's franchises.
So yeah. What is he working on now? Is he still doing murals? Has he moved on to some other medium?
A lot of these are mosaics now, and he's installing a mosaic near the tidal basin on Main Street Southwest, which is 1,200 square feet. There's a mosaic going on the Georgia Ave underpass in Silver Spring. He has a bunch of stuff going on.
It seems like he has a very strong connection to Washington, D.C.
Yes. His artwork is everywhere, from Columbia Heights to Silver Spring to this mural. It's interesting. He told me that sometimes developers who obscure his murals end up hiring him to do mural projects on their property.
One mural disappears, another one pops up somewhere else in town.
Right.
Well, Kim Bender, thank you so much for taking us to yet another interesting location and telling us all about it.
And thank you for having me and looking at the Black Family Reunion that soon may be no more.
It'll be interesting to see what's next for this corner.
Yeah.
Kim Bender writes the blog The Location. To read her article about G. Byron Peck and the Black Family Reunion, and to see photos of some of Mr. Peck's murals, including that Frederick Douglass mural that's all but obscured today, visit our website, metroconnection.org. Staying on the subject of urban development and how it changes the face of our communities and our region, we head now to the Northern Virginia neighborhood of Arlandria, Chiralagua, which has long drawn working-class Latinos. The Alexandria City Council recently approved a measure that would bring 53,000 square feet of retail space and 500 apartments to the neighborhood on a street where now you'll find few buildings more than two stories tall. A one-story, half-vacant strip mall will be destroyed to make room for the new development. And to many people passing through, it's just another strip mall. But to Ingris Moran, a 20-year-old woman who's lived her whole life near the three-block drag that makes up Arlandria, it's something much more. Moran took our reporter Emily Friedman through her neighborhood as it sits on the brink of gentrification.
My name is Ingris Moran. I was born and raised in Alexandria in the town Arlandria Chiralagua. I'm currently a student at Northern Virginia Community College. As well, I've been working a full-time at Mom's Organic Market, which is in the same neighborhood in Arlandria. I'm a cashier, and so I talk to a lot of customers, and that's actually how I found out about the whole redevelopment. This is Mount Vernon Avenue, and, you know, as you see, a lot of the places are Latino markets, grocery stores, you know. And most of Chiralagua starts from here and on. Everybody's either sending money to their countries or paying their cell phone bills. They call it here Los Chinos. I used to come here all the time as little kids and buy, you know, like, toys that probably break within a week you have them, you know, things like that, and of course, you can't really compare this, you know, to, like, Toys R Us or something. But, I mean, the kids don't really know, you know, oh, I have to have Barbie, or they're happy what they get, you know. The thing about Chiralagua, almost everybody knows everybody here. So most likely a lot of people will hand wave me or, because they know my parents and so on. So we can go, Hola. Bien, ¿y usted? Yeah. The waffle shop, everybody comes there. I used to come there as a little kid, and I remember back then the counters were more dirty, and it's usually open all night, so a lot of people come and eat, you know, like a steak and cheese and, you know, a waffle, and you're going to see, you know, like sometimes carne asada or something, and that didn't used to be there. It just comes to show how prominent the Latino culture is in here. The majority of the people that live in Chiralagua live in these apartments, and it's two streets. It's Russell and Executive. I remember living here and going to that playground as a kid, you know? My parents came here in the early 90s. They wanted to escape the Civil War in El Salvador because it was really tough economically, and it was a lot of danger there in the families, and they would have a lot of massacres and death squads over there. My dad, he is illiterate. He has jobs. He works as a dishwasher. My mom would always tell me, I don't want you cleaning toilets like me. As a little kid, I would have to, you know, translate each letter, each bill that we would have to do. So I would worry about money all the time. And are you going to pay the rent on time? Are you going to pay this on time? And so once we have this redevelopment, people are going to be moving in. Most likely people who work in D.C. and, you know, people who earn a lot of money. We're going to be realistic. The people here work construction, cleaning, and so they earn 20 grand annually.
people who live in the community, they're going to slowly be moving out. Possibly the managers from the other apartments are going to see, well, people are starting to move here a lot, so why don't we boost up our rents, you know? And that's when slowly the people are going to start moving out. A lot of people don't want to say this word, and they're afraid of this word, you know, gentrification, you know, the displacement of people. And I feel, sadly, it's going to happen.
That was Ingris Moran talking with Emily Friedman about her neighborhood of Arlandria Chirilagua in Alexandria. Now, our weekly trip around the region. On today's Door to Door, we visit Great Falls, Virginia, and Kingman Park in Northeast D.C.
Hi, my name is Bob Coomber. My wife and I have lived in Kingman Park for 3 years. Kingman Park is bounded on the east by the Anacostia River, on the north by Benning Road, on the south by East Capitol, and on the west, it's kind of hard to say, but it's either 19th Street, maybe 17th Street. Kingman Park is the only part of Ward 7 that is west of the river. It was built mostly in the 20s, 30s, and 40s. Carl Sager was the developer. He built very similar houses throughout the blocks. There are slight differences among the houses, but it's a pretty consistent single residential feel. I like just the mixture of people here. You have a very strong population of people who are first generation who have lived here since the community's founding. And then you have an influx of a lot of young families. We have a couple takeout restaurants and one significant restaurant bar, and then a bunch of other businesses that could be stronger. You have a lot of green space with Anacostia Park, Kingman Island, Heritage Island. It's kind of nice to be in a neighborhood that kind of has a suburban feel, but at the same time, you're right in the city. It's kind of a nice mix of the old and the new.
I am Karen Washburn. I am 62 years old, and I live in Great Falls, Virginia. Great Falls, as we know it today, is almost 18 square miles. It is a community of approximately 15,000 people. We have today this wonderful semi-rural community where large animals are quite welcome. Not everybody has horses, but a lot of people do. And we have an area where we have only single-family homes. The community of Great Falls was developed out of three farming communities. We had a community at Calvin Run, we had Forestville, and then we had Drainsville, and they have all been brought together under the umbrella of the new name Great Falls. Ironically, the actual Great Falls of the Potomac River have a McLean address. Along that riverfront, we have two very large parks. We have Great Falls National Park, which is 800 acres, and it is contiguous with Fairfax County Park, Riverbend. And within that park, we have phenomenal species of animals, which occur sometimes only in that Potomac Gorge. We have lovely birds that you can see, wonderful hiking trails. We can ride our horses on most of those trails. It's great for boaters, it's great for fishermen, and a lot of kayakers have taken up this as a great area to do their sport. And it's so beautiful to be able to see the birds, the wildlife. In all weathers, it is absolutely gorgeous, and if you go early, you don't see very many people.
We heard from Karen Washburn in Great Falls and Robert Coomber in Kingman Park. Your neighborhood can be a part of Door to Door, too. Just send an email to metro@wamu.org or visit us on Facebook. That's facebook.com/metroconnection.org. And to see a map of all the doors we've knocked on so far, visit our website, metroconnection.org. And that's Metro Connection for this week. We heard from WAMU's Sabri Benashour, Emily Friedman, Jessica Gould, Kavitha Cardoza, and Jonathan Wilson. Jim Ascendio is our news director. Our managing producer is Tara Boyle. Lauren Landau is our editorial assistant. Jonna McCone, Lauren Landau, and Heather Taylor produce Door to Door. Thanks, as always, to the WAMU engineering and digital media teams for their help with production and the Metro Connection website. Our theme song, Every Little Bit Hurts, our door-to-door theme, No Girl, and Turn Your Face, our theme for The Location, are from the album Title Tracks by John Davis and used with permission of the Ernest Jennings Record Company. You can see a list of all the music we use on our website, that's metroconnection.org. Just click on an individual story and you'll find all the information about its accompanying song. And while you're looking around metroconnection.org, you also can join us on Twitter and Facebook. You can read free transcripts of stories. And if you missed any part of today's show or want to listen to any of our recent shows, just click the podcast link up at the top of the page. We hope you can join us next week when we take a look at fear. We'll explore how our fears of crime may not always mesh with reality. We'll meet a Washingtonian who's facing his fear of discovering his true identity. And we'll check out a new exhibit that challenges artists to confront the things they dread.
I just try to push the envelope and find that area that is uncomfortable.
I'm Rebecca Shear, and thanks for listening to Metro Connection, a production of WAMU 88.5 News.